Welcome to Speaking with Joy, a podcast about books, beauty, and music. So make yourself a cup of tea, sit down, and let's begin. I will bring you where you can taste truth like honey and be embraced by it as a bridegroom. Your thirst shall be quenched. Hello, everyone, and welcome back to Reading with Joy. This is the third week in our summer book club where we're reading The Great Divorce, and this week we're looking at Chapter 5. I have my good friend and brother and roommate and song partner Joel again with me this week, and we are excited to talk about the sins of the intellect. Now, that is an interesting phrase, right? Because, and the Episcopalian Ghost brings this up. We'll give a little background to this week's kind of dialogue. Now, at this point in the story, we've gotten into heaven, on the edge of heaven, and we found that it's hard. And the kind of basic outline of all of these chapters from here on out is kind of these spirits, who are people who have made it to heaven, trying to convince the ghosts who are coming from the old town or hell to move into heaven so that their feet can harden and they can enter reality like we talked about last week. They can move from illusion to reality. And they're met by people who invite them into that, and they're able to kind of be beckoned in. So this week we have our good friend the Episcopalian Ghost, who is an intellectual, and we met him before. He was the one who had all sorts of interesting ideas about the spiritual city and how it wasn't he's the one who's talking about how, oh, it's all progressing. He's kind of like talking about the myth of progress, and it's all going to go forward and live in this mythical city.
In the bus.
Yeah, in the bus. He's talking to him. And this chapter is him talking with one of his previous colleagues. Now, to get us started, I thought that Joel and I would do a quick reading of, I think, one of the most salient passages, and then we'll discuss three points about it. And something that Joel and I noticed is it's actually odd that the ghost is called an Episcopalian. Because if you're in England, most of the time there's not an Episcopalian denomination, I don't think. It's the Anglicans, Church of England. But where we are in Scotland, you have the Scottish Episcopal Church, which is a branch of the Church of England. Yep. So we thought that maybe it might be referencing a Scottish.
It's either referencing Scottish or American, and because we're in Scotland, we thought we would lean into the Scottish.
Yes. So we're just imagining that both these characters are Scottish Episcopalians. Indeed. Because it's fun. And we'll do our best Scottish accents. However, Joel's is inevitably going to be better than mine.
Well, I don't know about that. We've been practicing for this year, so if you're Scottish, then you can give us your feedback at the end of the podcast.
Please don't. I'm sure I won't be very good at it. All right, so we're going to read a salient passage, and then we'll dive into this week's discussion.
But you must feel yourself that there is something stifling about the idea of finality. Stagnation, my dear boy. What is more soul-destroying than stagnation?
You think that. You think that because hitherto you have experienced truth only with the abstract intellect. I will bring you where you can taste it like honey and be embraced by it like a bridegroom. Your thirst shall be quenched.
Well, really, you know, I am not aware of a thirst for some ready-made truth which puts an end to intellectual activity in the way you seem to be describing. Will it leave me the free play of mind, Dick? I must insist on that, you know.
Free as a man is free to drink when he is drinking. He is not free still to be dry. The ghost seemed to think for a moment. I can make nothing of that idea. Oh, that's you.
I can make nothing of that idea, it said.
Listen, said the white spirit. Once you were a child, once you knew what inquiry was for, there was a time when you asked questions because you wanted answers. And were glad when you had found them. Become that child again, even now.
Ah, but when I became a man, I put away childish things.
You have gone far wrong. Thirst was made for water, inquiry for truth. What you now call free play of inquiry has neither more nor less to do with the ends which intelligence was given you than masturbation has to do with marriage.
If we cannot be reverent, there is at least no need to be obscene. The suggestion that I should return at my age to the mere factual inquisitiveness of boyhood strikes me as preposterous. In any case, that question and answer conception of thought only applies to matters of fact. Religious and speculative questions are surely on a different level.
We can know nothing of religion here. We think only of Christ. We know nothing of speculation. Come and see. I will bring you to the eternal fact, the father of all fatherhood, of facthood.
I should object very strongly to describing God as fact. The supreme value would surely be less inadequate description. It is hardly...
Do you even believe that he exists?
Exists? What does existence mean? You will keep on implying some sort of static, ready-made reality which is, so to speak, there, and to which our minds have simply to conform. These great mysteries cannot be approached in that way. If there was such a thing, there is no need to interrupt, my dear boy. Quite frankly, I should not be interested in it. It would be of no religious significance. God, for me, is something purely spiritual. The spirit of sweetness and light and tolerance. Service, Dick. Service. We mustn't forget that, you know.
If the thirst of the reason really is dead, then can you at least still desire happiness? All right, so we'll pause there. So this kind of outlines for us the whole bit that we're going to talk about this week. I hope you enjoyed our attempts at Scottish accents. I think Joel's is very impressive.
Oh, I think we just have maybe different regions. I don't know. Maybe an expert can tell us.
Where am I from?
I'm not sure.
Oh, dear. One of our friends who is a Fifer where we live told us that Joel could properly sound like he's from Scotland.
At least in moments.
Yeah. No, she was quite confident.
I barely said anything.
Yes. But anyway.
That's the trick.
So this is what we're looking at this week. What is it that's keeping this ghost from wanting to progress into heaven? And we're told at the very beginning, very outright, that it's because he's an apostate and because he has engaged in the sins of the intellect. Now, I remember when I first read this, I was a little kind of like, ooh, because I thought, I don't like the idea that that God's just, you know, condemning people for having the wrong beliefs. And Dick is also worried about that. So this is the question this week is, what went wrong with this ghost? And we're going to look at three different questions with this and kind of talk through it. And I have some quotes. And we're also going to be bringing in an essay by Lewis called The Myth Became Fact, because I think that I can't actually remember if he wrote this before or after The Great Divorce, but one of them is conversing with the other. So we'll be looking at what goes wrong with this ghost. Then secondly, what is the intellect for under Lewis's mindset? And then finally, we'll be looking at, ultimately, where should the intellect lead us? Because there's a sense that Dick is stopping short. I'm going to call him the Episcopalian ghost. Yeah. The Episcopalian ghost is stopping short. Mm-hmm. So why is he stopping short? So what should the intellect bring us to? So those are our three questions. So first, we're going to talk about what is wrong with the Episcopalian ghost. Also, Lewis, thanks for throwing some shade. We love Episcopalians.
Yeah.
I don't know why he chose that in particular.
I don't know.
It's funny. Okay, so I'm going to begin. So the first question is, what went wrong with this ghost? And so to start off, I have a quote for you from The Myth Became Fact, which I'll post on both of the pages. And this is the opening section from The Myth Became Fact. He says, "My friend Corineus has advanced the charge that none of us are in fact Christians at all. According to him, historic Christianity is something so barbarous that no modern man can really believe it. The moderns who claim to do so are in fact believing a modern system of thought which retains the vocabulary of Christianity and exploits the emotions inherited from it, while quietly dropping its essential doctrines." Corineus compared modern Christianity with the modern English monarchy. The forms of kingship have been retained, but the reality has been abandoned. So I think this has to be kind of describing our Episcopalian ghost friend, who seems indeed to have, what does he say, have a modern system of thought which retains vocabulary and exploits the emotions while dropping all the reality. Do you think that's what's gone wrong with the Episcopalian ghost?
Yeah, I think he's set up a construct of thought, of belief, of sort of like, it is dogmatic in a sense. But at the same time, he wants to remove the sort of finality of that mm-hmm. dogma, so that purely the belief itself, that the act of believing, mm-hmm. he can imagine is somehow worthy of praising, and he's removed it from sort of any like.
Yeah, that's a really interesting point. I think that he, instead of using his intellect to get to a point where he can find the truth and then honor the truth, he kind of praises just the act of thinking itself as something valuable.
He's not interested in the truth. He's interested in
the feeling of
moving toward the truth.
Which I can say, and this is not like a criticism academia outside of myself, one of the
great pitfalls of being in academia is that we all love to hear our own voices and all kind of love the feeling of discovering something true.
Yeah.
Well, we love the feeling of sounding like we discovered something true.
Yeah, it's one of the great dangers that you can say something that is very interesting and possibly true and believe that then, therefore, because you have articulated it well, it is absolutely true.
Yeah, so it's that sense of that he's lost the joy of discovery, which is what we get from that passage, right? He says, I'm not like a kid anymore. I don't just want, you know, just delight in the truth. He's lost the joy of discovery and instead has kind of this joy of just saying things that sound clever. So I think that sets up what's wrong with this ghost. It's that he's learned to love the exercise of intellect, but he doesn't love the actual discovery of truth.
Mm-hmm.
And in the claim of myth became fact, he is, he's kind of who Corneus as who writes Lewis. He's who he's describing. He's left all the reality of it behind and kind of uses this thing to make himself feel good and be modern.
Yeah, and to hold the person that is asking him to engage with truth at a distance.
Yes. So that brings us to our second question, which is if the Episcopalian ghost is using his intellect in an incorrect way, what does Lewis think that the intellect is for? What is the sin of his intellect? So we already see kind of one sin of his intellect, which is that he's prideful, right? That he just likes to seem as though he's saying something true. And that's also when he talks earlier in the chapter, he says, we just said whatever people would applaud us for. So that there's that. But I don't think that's the essential sin of the intellect, because I think the essential sin is that he's not using it for what it's for.
Well, and interestingly enough, he wants the spirit who has been sent here to lead him. He wants that spirit to give him mercy and say that he should receive some sort of due that is owed him because he has just believed sincerely.
Yep.
And the ironic thing is that he's acting like what the spirit is telling him is that because he's wrong, he's condemned. But he's literally sitting here on the edge of heaven being invited into it.
Yeah, so he's not condemned for his wrong beliefs, or else he wouldn't be there.
In some sense, the sin of the intellect is that he won't engage with reality itself because he wants to be justified in why he made the decisions he did.
So this is where we get to what is the intellect for? Now, in this, you have this wonderful thing where he says, the intellect is for finding truth, right? That we're supposed to use it to discover what is true about reality. And so it's for something. It's a tool. It's something that gets us somewhere. But there's a problem with that, which is that to think, to use the intellect, is always to set yourself apart from something, right? If I'm going to say things about, I don't know why, I always use you as an example because you're standing next to me. If I'm going to say things about Joel, I have to kind of set him at a distance from myself and look at him and deduce things about him and, you know, set him at a distance. That's different than being in a relationship with Joel and to be, you know, having a sibling relationship with someone.
There's a knowledge that comes in that relationship that doesn't even require sort of the defense of stating what is true or false. You know it. You've experienced it.
Yeah. So this actually plays very closely to The Myth Became Fact. Yep. Same essay, which I think I'll put it in the blog post. I can't remember which one he wrote first, but they're definitely conversing with each other. Joel, I'm going to have you read this.
Sure.
So start here. This is from Myth Became Fact.
Stubbornly want me to.
Human.
Yep. Human intellect is incurably abstract. Pure mathematics is the type of successful thought. Yet the only realities we experience are concrete. This pain, this pleasure, this dog, this man. While we are loving the man, bearing the pain, enjoying the pleasure, we are not intellectually apprehending pleasure, pain, or personality. When we begin to do so, on the other hand, the concrete realities sink to the level of mere instances or examples. We are no longer dealing with them, but with that which they exemplify. This is our dilemma, either to taste and not to know, or to know and not to taste, or more strictly, to lack one kind of knowledge because we are in an experience, or to lack another kind because we are outside it. As thinkers, we are cut off from what we think about. As tasting, touching, willing, loving, hating, we do not clearly understand. The more lucidly we think, the more we are cut off. The more deeply we enter into reality, the less we can think. You cannot study pleasure in the moment of the nuptial embrace, nor repentance while repenting, nor analyze the nature of humor while roaring with laughter. But when else can you really know these things? If only my toothache would stop, I could write another chapter about pain. But once it stops, what do I know about pain?
So here Lewis is describing the problem of the intellect. And I think this is the problem of the ghost, which is
the idea that to think about something, we always have to separate ourselves from it. And this is ultimately what I think the ghost has done, don't you? He's thought about these heavenly things so much that he's not willing to actually enter into the realities that he thinks about. Do you think that's what's happening?
Yeah, I think he won't let go of his right to think.
Yes. And it's funny because, you know, he spent his whole life talking about heaven, but when he's on the edge of it, he won't enter it.
Yeah.
So the misuse of his intellect is that he set himself from a distance and not allowed himself to enter into the reality that he's always talked about. It's interesting, too. I think that could make it sound like the intellect was very bad. But I've been doing some study on Bonaventure, who was a wonderful, I call him the devoted theologian, because he was both incredibly learned and he knew a lot, and he was very artful in his ability to argue, but he also always thought that intellect should always lead to devotion. There's a sense that intellect is like a guide. So he has this book where he writes about the soul's journey into God, and the way he depicts it is that the intellect and reason help kind of guide us along the way. They help us read the world and bring us closer. But at the end of it, at the heart of it, once we come to God, we don't relate to God with our intellect. We relate to him as a person to a reality.
Yeah.
And that the true use of the intellect is allowing it to kind of guide us along the path to the point where we can enter into relationship with reality.
Yeah.
And so I think that the issue is that this ghost, rather than using the intellect as a tool that brings him towards God, he has used the intellect as God itself, the thing that he praises above everything
yeah.
else.
Yeah, in a sense, you need the intellect to give you the parameters of where you are in regard to who God is and where God is.
Mm-hmm.
But what the intellect can't do is draw you into the infinite and
relationship.
The infinite person that God is beyond understanding. It can simply help you regard the fact that there is this thing and there's a distance between you. What draws you into relationship with that thing, with that with that impersonated divinity is moving past the intellect and into experience, into knowing.
Yeah, and I think this is really well demonstrated in the passage we read, right? Because he says, I'll lead you to a place where you've only known truth in your head, but I'll lead you to a place where you can touch it and embrace it.
Yeah.
And that's also very much Augustinian. There's like a section where he talks about that. But also in Bonaventure, he has this picture of, you have these levels where he's getting closer and closer to union with God. It's this very mystical text.
Yeah.
And he goes through 6 levels with the intellect. And then at the 7th, he says, all right, it's time to enter the darkness. At this final stage, you have to let the intellect dally behind, as one of the one of the writers says.
Yeah.
So I think that's the issue with him, is that he's using the intellect as not as a tool, but as the ultimate thing, and he's allowing it to separate himself from reality.
Yeah.
And he won't make that final step. He won't step into reality. He wants always to be one step away from it. And so that leads us to our final question, which is ultimately, where should the intellect lead us? And I think we kind of already started to answer this. But I think that the use of the intellect should be to kind of follow the path, and then once we see reality, to enter into it.
Yeah, and I think bringing back, you mentioned Augustine, and we're thinking back to some of the couple of the previous podcasts, we've already talked a little bit about this when we talked about Augustine. There's, you know, the sense in which sin is privation, which it moves us away, not just from God, but from existence itself.
Mm-hmm.
So when you see these ghosts, part of their embodiment is that they're not quite yet fully aligned with reality.
Mm-hmm.
They're moving away from sort of this hellish place and into possibly toward heaven. And when that happens, it will embody them. And so for this ghost, in a certain sense, his embodiment is to allow his intellect to do what it is made to do, which is
to lead him to union.
Yeah, and the process of that is actually an embodying process.
Yep, and I think it's interesting, too, because it goes back to that idea of everything curving inward, because he's literally trapped in the box of his mind. Because he can only think about things separated from them, he is literally separated from all of reality.
Right.
And what he needs to do is have a turn outward of his will towards reality. And I think one way I like to think of this is that it's the difference between believing that things and believing in things. So he has believed that these various things all of his life. But when you say the creed, for Christians, you say, I believe in God.
Yeah.
You know, you say, I believe in these things. There's this wonderful podcast where Malcolm Guyot talks about that to believe in something is to have a relationship to it, to be moved by it, to
be immersed within it. And that's what's ultimately being asked of this ghost, is to not dally behind the affections, but to let the intellect dally behind. To ultimately come to that step where you don't just believe that, but that you enter into the reality you believe in. And that's kind of what I was thinking about this week. And I think this could, let's just think about what applications could this have to our actual lives. And I will say mine, and then if you think maybe sure. Say yours. I think for me, this has like a very practical implication, which is that we're both overthinkers. We're both, mm-hmm. We wouldn't be that way if we weren't in, we wouldn't be in academia if we weren't that way.
Yeah.
Maybe we wouldn't be that way if we were in academia.
know,
who's to say?
We'll never know.
but I think for me, it's very easy for me to think through things and to stay inside my head about things. But there can sometimes be this lack of momentum towards movement. There can be a lack of willingness to, I can know the right thing to do, whether that is moving towards relationship God or, you know, doing right by a person or, there's a task I need to do. I can think it all out in my head, but sometimes it's hard for me to make that step. And in a funny way, this very practically, this chapter always reminds me to not become trapped in kind of the box of my mind. So whether that's knowing what is right to do in my life, or whether that's being able to make a perfect case for justice, but never actually want to take any steps towards helping people, I think this encourages us to think about making the step outside of our intellect towards the next step of action.
Yeah, yeah. I think as 21st century people, we have learned sort of to engage with this idea of belief and of being able mm-hmm. to say what we believe. And that's an important thing. And but I think as Joy is saying, part of this sort of I believe in is it requires you to sort of enter into this thing. So for me, participating mm-hmm. In good relationships and conversations, saying is not outside of the bounds of that. Conversation can be a really powerful part of this, because that is itself an effective thing that draws you in, mm-hmm. because it requires you to come out of your own sort of ideas and let them find rooting in another person and find out if they actually can grow or not.
Yeah, totally. And one last thing that just came to me, and this is actually, I don't know why I didn't say this first, because it's been a really important thing in my life, was sometimes it has been presented to me that Christianity is like a list of various things that you needed to kind of go, oh yes, I agree with that.
Right.
And there's two problems with this. One is that sometimes we have questions and doubts and issues, or we just don't understand. Does that mean then that our salvation is suspended every time we have a question? And then the other issue with this was that I often would feel like, well, what does this have to do with my life, with the way I live, with the relationships I have? And coming to realize that the heart of Christianity is not meant to be a series of facts we believe, but this irreducible reality, which is relationship with God and salvation and the love that permeates the world, that changed my whole view of how I relate to my faith. Because it's no longer kind of rehearsing in my mind the right things, the things I should know, and the beliefs I should have, but always being invited into that reality that moves me. Yeah. So
I couldn't have said it better myself.
Well, friends, I hope you have a lovely week. We are off to sleep. It is bright and sunshiny and almost 11 p.m. because we live in Scotland. We will talk to you next week, and I hope you have a lovely day.